Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dobrý večer and welcome to the Bohemican Podcast with Piet Coleman and Travis Doe.
Hello and welcome to the Bohemican Podcast. I'm your host, Piet Coleman.
And I'm Travis Doe from the Secret Cabinet.
Alfons Mucha was born in Ivančice, Moravia. Now, before we go even further, we want to make sure that you know who we're talking about. So stop what you're doing right now. Actually, we don't want you to stop the podcast. Listen to the podcast while we're talking. You can Google and do two things at once. I'm sure you can. All right.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
All right. And go and do a search for Mucha. That's M-U-C-H-A. And you'll come up with some imagery that I'm sure that you find also fascinating, but also something that's very familiar, because his work has been imaged across nationalities, across time, and has been copied many times moreover, because he was a trendsetter. He was an artist that really took his art to a whole new level.
Also, you can also, I'm sure we'll post pictures on bohemican.com, or if you find Bohemican on Acast, there'll be a picture embedded in the player, I'm sure. Because
this is really hard. Isn't you right, Travis?
It's the epitome of Art Nouveau. You'll know exactly who this guy is. You'll be like, oh, he's that guy. He is like the Art Nouveau guy. Yeah, that's who we're talking about.
You coined it right. Art Nouveau. That's what you need to keep in your head about this. And I think that this is one of the hardest things we have to do from an audio podcast standpoint, is to be able to talk about maybe an artist's work. We talk ad infinitum about people and culture and histories and the great things that they've done, including music. And we talk about some of the battles or some of the political gains that were made. It gets really tough when you're trying to do something of a visual on an audio podcast.
Yeah. And his work is really, as you're about to find out, is for some of it, it's really awe inspiring to see it in person. I just, even the scale, it's just a ginormous scale, some of his works. And that doesn't really come across in a podcast. So we'll do our best. But on this episode, maybe more than others, we encourage you to stop by bohemican.com to look at some of the pictures of what we're talking about. And in Acast, I don't know if we'll get around to it or not, but it does have the ability to kind of have a slideshow embedded into it. So that's an option, but that's more time consuming. But definitely swing by bohemican.com to take a look at like the stained glass windows we're talking about, or the typeface, or his style in general and how it changed throughout the years. You know, we'll try to clarify that on the website. So
as the man Mucha, we look at him and we think, well, you know what? He's got to be the favorite son of Bohemia, and even so more, the favorite son of Prague. But that's really not really the case, because there's so many other towns and countries that want to name him son. That would be Vienna. That would be Paris. That would be even New York City. He spent time in New York during his artistic renderings and trying to get an idea about what his image would be. He really was a well-traveled man for the era of the late 19th century, and he was a man that really was a trailblazer in his art. But he didn't start off as an artist, Travis. That was kind of very interesting about this. He had a good singing voice, and he was able to get through high school with his voice alone. But it was his drawings that was really his real hobby. But he kind of kept that to himself. He didn't really want to expose that to a lot of other people. But when he was young, but he did show his work in Brno, mostly in his theater scenery. So he would be the guy responsible for the backdrops of these great plays in the city of Brno, which is today's de facto capital of Moravia here in the Czech Republic, and another town that claims to be his town, by the way. We'll get to that later. All right. So he finally got a job in Vienna in 1879 for work as a designer in a design company. So he kind of took the circuitous sort of route to where he wanted to be as an artist. And I think he took something that was a hobby and made it into a profession and later became a legend.
In the time in Vienna didn't last. It only lasted a couple of years when, unfortunately, this designer, well, actually, fortunately for his future career, but his gig in Vienna didn't last all that long because his employer's business burnt down in 1881, and he returned to Moravia. And now, luckily, for a short time, he was just kind of surviving, doing freelance, decorative, and portrait painting. But he got a break, and if you go to the museum in Prague, there's more than one, but there's a great museum that exhibits a lot of his stuff in Prague, and they show a video, because even this is now gone, but he got a gig from a count, a nobleman who wanted him to kind of decorate his, in Hruszowany, the Emmerhof Castle, just deck it out with murals, the whole nine yards. There's video of this, there's photographs of this, but that castle itself burnt down. So Mucha's earliest works is actually all destroyed. But this did kind of give him a name. This was definitely a big contract, you know, to paint the inside of a whole castle. And it was very impressive. And so this count, Karl Kuen of Mikhailov, agreed to sponsor Mucha's formal training at the Munich Academy of Fine Arts. Another city that's kind of proud of Mucha, but he went, you know, he moved on. So he went to Paris in 1887, and it's Paris. We should focus on Paris for a little bit because Paris is really where he made his name.
His coming out party. Yeah.
This is like, one thing I want to point out that you kind of have in the back of your mind as we discuss Mucha is that Mucha, his whole life, was a proud Moravian. And Pete and I just recorded a show on Greater Moravia, and so if you want to hear about what a proud Moravian is or why there's proud Moravians, go listen to Greater Moravia. But Mucha lived in the time in the late 19th century under Austro-Hungarian rule, and he found a lot of success in Paris, but he kind of, you know, he yearned for Prague, he yearned for his home, didn't like that the Slavs were under the yoke of the Germans in Austria-Hungary, or the Hungarians for the Slovaks case. And he was very hyper-aware of all this and wrote about this and read about this and liked to show this in his paintings. The problem is that didn't really sell. What sold was theater posters. And really, this is where he got his name in Paris, was these plays would create these big posters to display on the street, and they would be basically printed. And, you know, famous ones include, like, if you go to a museum, you'll see a bunch with Sarah Bernhardt. The people that made theater plays with her also preferred Mucha, and it kind of became a thing that... So you see this, like you see him portraying the actress as many characters, as Cleopatra, as just all kinds of, in the French Art Nouveau form with this flowery border and lots of colors and, you know, low contrast, but a lot of
It translates very well to stained glass windows even. You kind of get that idea of how that would go across with it. The multiple bits of color. Trev, sorry to interrupt you with this, but I think this is a good point to bring this up. And these lithographs that you see, or these big posters, nothing compared to it at the time. Everything was drab, you know, compared to what Mucha was able to put out in Paris. And the Parisians just fell in love with this stuff. And you're right.
Hold on. Yeah? Parisians love this stuff now. I wouldn't say they fell in love with it overnight. Because fact of the matter is that Parisians can be very conservative, and they want nothing with the word nouveau anywhere. Like to say Art Nouveau, in German. So first of all, let me make a quick point about Art Nouveau. Art Nouveau is the style that people started to call Mucha's style, not the other way around. Okay, so. Everybody, I assume, knows what Art Nouveau is. That's Mucha. Mucha, people coined it to describe his work, okay? And it's the new art. And in German, it's not called like that. It's called the Jugendstil, the young style. Because also it's a break from the old, like in, if you, I don't know if you've looked into history of art, it's a radical shift at this time. And then other later eras are kind of more derivative, like Art Deco has more to do with this than it does from the stuff before it. So really Mucha was revolutionary. So yes, he's iconic in Paris today, and Parisians, everything from, so in those movie theater, in his early days, those movie theaters, he created a typeface, basically a very certain style of letters that he started using. And you're familiar with it. I guarantee if you go to a French restaurant, that's the font. That's what I'm talking about. It's that Art Nouveau Mucha, that Mucha created that and used that in his,
So you see it on the subways underground that you see in Paris.
Metro,
the Metropole.
The Metro logo itself is Mucha's typeface.
Exactly.
Yep.
Well, Travis, you mentioned Sarah Bernhardt as one of his earlier sort of people that sat for him so he could draw them and put them into, you know, this sort of iconic sort of posters that you would use for theater posters. You know, that's really what he would take beautiful women and he would put them, you know, right in front of him, and he would just freehand. He would freehand draw and get an idea of their features, and then add the flowery sort of things to their hair, or make them look like goddesses, or maybe who they were supposed to be acting the role that they were supposed to take in the theater.
Yeah.
He would make that person into this role, and he just did an amazing job of it, with these flowing neoclassical sort of looking robes that would come through, and he often would surround the women with beautiful flowers and form these halos behind their heads. So really, he made everything else look really drab and standing still, compared to his style that was given. Mucha's style really took an international exposure, a leap and bounds by the year 1900 at the Universal Exhibition in Paris, in which Mucha said, "I think that this exposition made some contribution towards bringing aesthetic values into arts and crafts." All right, I don't know if that's more of a backhanded sort of compliment to it at all. I wouldn't look at what he would do as arts and crafts. I don't know if that was a self-effacing sort of deal or tongue-in-cheek, because as Travis, you said, people in Paris at the time of the turn of the century didn't really appreciate the stuff as they would later. I think that it does take a lot of foresight to see what he had done on canvas and see that he really captured, you know, a real sense of the models that he was drawing and painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that at this time, if I'm not mistaken, he was getting a lot of people from overseas that were more appreciative of his work in North America, specifically a lot of these nouveau rich people in New York City wanted him to do work for him. So he had a free ticket to go to the United States. And while he was there, he was learning more about his trade. He was making a lot of money, and he was getting also a thought about what the New World was like. You know, we're talking New York in the turn of the century. It was a hopping place, probably kind of dirty and busy at the same time, but very different from Prague, very different from Paris. And I think he took that energy with him when he came back to Europe. And you'll see the big changes that he was doing in his artwork right after the year 1900.
Yeah, that's right. Everything you just said is actually really important in his story. And then also, to a degree, to Czech stories, because in the United States is where he met his first connections of people with money, like you said. But he also met some of the interesting people that were interested in kind of revolutions in general, and, you know, these big rich millionaires in New York City that were interested in the affairs of Europe. As an example is like Charles R. Crane, who also met Tomáš Masaryk, who we're going to do an episode on in this period, and he was the first Czechoslovak president. And so I guess my point is that Mucha was in these circles, and when he came back to Prague, it was this man that returned to Prague. He now returned to Prague with a family. He had gotten married. He married a Czech girl. He had a son and a daughter. And when he returned to Prague now, it was as a known entity, and he wanted to show his Czech compatriots that he had not sold out, literally. Like, he didn't go to Paris and become French and go to New York and become American. Now he wanted to prove to the Czechs that he's still proud of being a Moravian.
Proud to be Slav. I mean, yes. this is, and we're going to get this a little later on in the show tonight, but
this is where all that starts. This is where, yes. I don't know, I don't want to bring you out of your order here, but this is like instantly from coming back into Prague, we start seeing the municipal house. And I almost want to say you've seen a picture of it. You just don't know what you're looking at if you've seen pictures of Prague, because everybody that goes to Prague takes a picture of the municipal house. And he's done the inside, so you might not see Mucha's work just by taking the picture of the outside, but there's some gorgeous murals in there and great artwork. And this is from that time. And so still, let's say 1910, before World War I. And he had time to do this. And there was another. Oh, the Theater of Fine Arts. Yeah, he got that contract before the war, already under the Austrians. You know, so the Austrians already had his respect and you know, brought him to Austria. In the World Fair, like you said, in Paris, he also did decorate a part of the Austrian house in the World Fair. So, you know, Austrians liked him even too. It's interesting.
You know, he was commissioned, you know, for post World War I to make these, you know, beautiful sort of epic drawings and paintings to, you know, usher in the Czechoslovakian new government.
Yeah,
and you mentioned his connection he had with T.G. Masaryk.
Let me make one strong break here in the podcast. Okay, there's pre-war. His rise to fame and then getting the fine arts and the municipal house commissions. And then there's post-war, and you're like, before we go there, let me just say now he is a star with no bounds, because the young nation of Czechoslovakia just embraces him as a symbol of what Czechs are capable of. Because he's loved in New York, he's loved in Paris, he's loved in Vienna, Munich, you name it. He's internationally famous.
Making a pan-Slavic sort of movement of being proud to be Slavic
takes hold. Yeah,
it was a void that he filled.
Yeah,
and not only did he do this, he said, "I'm going to recreate history."
And one more thing I want to add before we get to pan-Slavism is his love, the Czechoslovak love for Mucha in this era can be seen in, and now these are all the works he was paid for, mind you, because when we get to the Pan-Slav epic, this is basically, he made enough money to support himself. No one really wanted to pay for this. He had to like beg noblemen for money, and we'll get to that, but as far as what he did for the nation of Czechoslovakia, he designed stamps, which I try my best to collect, like Mucha. I'm not a stamp collector, but I like Mucha stamps and Mucha coin bills. He also created some of the banknotes in the First Republic. These stained glass windows of St. Vitus were commissioned in this time, and some of the stained glass windows, and you'll be able to see in a split second which ones are which. Because it's very Art Nouveau. Like we've mentioned previously, the St. Vitus Cathedral in the Prague Castle was finished in like 1927. So, you know, at the height of Mucha's fame. But that's not what Mucha, that was not his pet project. That was not his passion, right? His passion was, like you said, these philosophical ideas of what it means to be Slavic and, you know, not to be, you know, the troubles of Slavs, right? Remember that Russians just abolished serfdom in, what, the 19th century? I mean, it was, like, recent. Or even, you know, really in World War I, if you think about it. You know, one of the last czars started, and really the communists really changed things.
You know, and when you see the Slav epics, you know, with these giant canvas paintings of size of a building.
Giant.
Huge. That you see that.
Give us do you have a measurement? Because I want people to imagine how big these things are.
I don't know if we have a measurement in our notes today.
When you stand in, okay, let me guess. I'll tell you, it's taller than me for one thing. I mean, if you have them sitting on the floor, it's taller than me. It's 7, 8, 9 feet tall, and wider than that. Okay,
I can't, Travis, I probably would say that wouldn't do it justice.
No, I know, but I don't want to. I don't want to. The thing is, I don't want to over exaggerate how big these are. They're freaking huge. You can. There's several paces.
Is that a metric?
They're freaking huge. They are, at least, I don't know, 50 feet. I mean, there's several paces. You walk past each one, and they're a series. So there's multiple. There's a dozen or more. I mean, he never really finished the project, and some of them are in Prague, and just like four of them will fill a room. You know, because it's just each one is a wall. So, I mean, that's now you're starting to get the picture of just how the scale of these paintings. When you stand in front of them, they cover your field of vision. You're completely immersed.
And that is
it's
tricky.
It's IMAX 3D for oil paintings. Amazing.
When you stand too close to it, you don't get really the grandiose view of it. You really need to step back
however,
from it.
You need to do both because the detail is there. And many people, if you go look online and you look up Mucha's Pond Slavs, so many times you'll get a tiny fraction of the big thing because there'll be like a woman holding a child, okay? And that part of the painting is only a couple inches or maybe a foot squared, altogether out of this, 20 foot by 10 foot, 30, 50 foot by 10 foot. Epic portrait, and that is one of a dozen, which means you need to first of all walk up really close and kind of scan it all over and then take a step back and take it all in. I mean, it's something you need to like study and really like it, and it's they're all saying a picture, they're all talking about Slavic past, the including the serfdom in Russia and other aspects and Austrians and just all kinds of, some of it's a little bit symbolic and goes back to mythology or it's a very romantic kind of artwork style. But very realistic, very well done. Not so much Art Nouveau like his other stuff. It's a class of its own. It really is his life work. I mean, he would tell you it was his life's work.
So, Travis, you and I at different periods of time while living here in Prague, have been to some of these, great exhibitions of the Slavic epic, the Slav epic that Mucha had done. And they are immense. They are huge. They're basically a tour of his viewpoint of history. Now, at this time in Czechoslovakia, or the before Czechoslovakia, rather, when they're still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the idea of rise of nationalism and the national pride to take within being Czech was really the same. So this really was at the crossroads, and you'll see that. He was trying very hard not only to bring Czechs together, but also Russo-Slavic folks to the table as well. You will see glorification of the famous general Jan Žižka, who some feel was a terrorist of his day. Others feel he was a religious freedom fighter. You'll see that, as you mentioned, Travis, you'll see a lot of serfs struggling with poverty and starvation in the forefront, in the foreground of a painting that deals with the Kremlin.
Right.
Oh, Moscow, yep. Moscovites. You'll see some of that. You'll see some of the battles of Ottokar II. You'll see some of the greatest moments in Czech history, in Bohemian history, that are there. The Battle of Marchfield, where Ottokar II fell. It really is amazing to see this. Yet I still think that you go in and you think, wow, this is a little bit of propaganda.
My views on nationalism. However, but Mucha totally was just, we see this with many, many people, that he was among Czechs, that he was a product of his time because the Czechs really wanted freedom and as Czechs, they wanted freedom, which means this nationalistic sense was encouraged. It was, I would even say, it was for the Czechs a good thing, even though I'm strictly anti-nationalist. But we see this in the ice hockey movement, in the Sokol movement, in the Czech legions, all this. And then, and Mucha was alive for all of this. And now it's the First Republic when they're celebrating their freedom. But there were already people that thought he went too far, definitely. There were already people saying, now, wait a minute. Pan-Slavism, is that really such a good idea? You know who else really wants Pan-Slavism?
The Russians.
The Soviet Union. Not right. The Russians, specifically, the Soviet Union loves the idea of Pan-Slavism. And it was also featured at the very forefront of Soviet art. You know, the Soviet realism, the Russian realism or whatever, socialist realism or whatever it's called. That style featured Pan-Slavic ideas all the time. The bad aspects of nationalism, because he did want, you know, he's like, we all speak Slavic, we should all be part of a bigger brotherhood, not just Czechs, not just Moravians. So, you know, an idealist, right? I think every idealist is flawed in a way. but absolutely, you know, he did have a passion. He strongly believed in those ideas and those philosophies, and was able to express them beautifully. I mean, just amazing stuff. I want to go back to Prague and see him again. Just talking about this makes me want to go to that museum and just it's really something, you know.
Well, that's if his stuff is still there, because as we get to his legacy. We'll see that there's been a tug of war of where to put, if there could be such a thing, the Mucha Museum, National Museum in the Czech Republic. And, you know, his works go back and forth between the town of Brno and in between the Prague. But looking ahead towards his death, you know, it wasn't actually a very, very good end for a man that was so internationally well-renowned. The rising tide of fascism during the late 1930s resulted in Mucha's work and his Slavic nationalism being denounced, as we just talked about, by the press as reactionary. When German troops moved into Czechoslovakia during the spring of 1939, Mucha was among the first persons to be arrested by the Gestapo. So, could you imagine being, you know, someone knocking on your door for that, Travis? I mean, yeah, you know, and some crazy stuff.
At this point, seriously, 39, he was elderly. He was, you know.
Yeah,
like, come on.
They would have had to help him out the door.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he was in that bad shape then, but he was. Yeah, I mean, he was not. You know,
well,
he
no,
was
he was.
Of
he,
his life. Yeah.
He was battling pneumonia and everything, so he was very ill when all this.
Oh no, the pneumonia yeah. Actually might have caught that during the interrogation.
I wouldn't be surprised,
because that's the thing. Well, so everybody likes to blame the Nazis, myself included. But I'm at least aware that I have that bias. I honestly, openly hate the Nazis, and so yeah, of course it's the Nazis' fault. They gave him pneumonia, but it's not all sources agree, and I think we'll never know this for a fact. But he did die of complications, you know, later, and he was weakened by the interrogation. I would go out on a limb and say that's safe to say. And he did get pneumonia shortly thereafter or had it even then, perhaps got it during the interrogation.
We did a tour with a couple people, and we went past near the Loreto Church near
Prague
Castle.
Oh, I know where you're going. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there was the
Gestapo interrogation
rooms. Exactly. Do you think he was taken there?
I don't know. So that was the Gestapo headquarters, and probably yes. There are okay. later... in the war, there were later interrogations where I know for a fact, like that room, that window, that's where they were. Mucha probably that site, but he was like you said, he was one of the first to be arrested, so maybe they had a more temporary place. But they took over it was an Austro-Hungarian police building, which then the First Republic used it as a police building, and then the Gestapo took it over, and then it became the Czechoslovak secret police, kind of like the Czechoslovak version of the KGB headquarters in communist times. And it's a police building to this day. It's still a police building. So people were actually killed in those rooms and tortured and all that by communists. There's a really famous communist case. But yeah, exactly. Mucha, there's a good chance that Mucha was, and this is verifiable. I'm just being lazy. But yeah, Mucha could have been held in those rooms behind the castle kind of.
All the stress on an old man at this point took its toll, and with the pneumonia and who knows what else happened with the torture. But he passed away in Prague on the 14th of July in 1939 due to a lung infection, probably on the onset from the pneumonia taking its toll. And he was later interred in Vyšehrad Cemetery, which is one of the more famous cemeteries in Prague.
Right by where I used to live. It was like a couple blocks from my house.
You know, who was in there, to be honest with you, all of poet laureates and politicians and you name it, they're all there, including Mucha is there. So, you know, we talk about his legacy, Trav, man. One thing that kind of sticks out to me was the tug of war between getting his work or putting a giant museum here in Prague just dedicated to him, foundation, lay it down, you know, brick and mortar, it's there. It's not doing that because there's something that goes back to his time in his life when he was trying to make money and he was not having a good opportunity to sell some of his works, and some places didn't want to pay him for his work because he was late or they didn't like it or there was something else that came in fashion, and he held grudges with these things from what I remember.
I just gotta say this is you know, this is the art world of the 1920s, okay? So this is like, there's a whole lot of stuff going on. Art Nouveau had a heyday like hardly any art fad or art style had. Like, it was international. It took, we think of Paris, but, you know, now we've established he's Czech. But it took Paris by storm. I mentioned today, if you go to a French restaurant, it's probably going to be that font. But it was, you know, there was all kinds of other things going on in the art world, and Art Deco took over as being more popular. There was other, you know, Cubism, Picasso had nothing to do with Art Nouveau. You know, he went off in his own direction, and there's just all these other things. And so, of course, they all criticize Art Nouveau as being too this or too that or whatever. But it was already, towards the end of his lifetime, you know, falling out of favor, considered old-fashioned. World War II definitely put a kibosh on it. World War II, you get all these anti-art movements, you know, it's a black era again. And that's the art world. That doesn't really, you know, but of course, everything, you know, history is cyclical in a way. And there was a huge revival in the 60s. If you think of, like, some of the psychedelic artwork, some of that writing and some of that artwork is like Mucha influenced, the patterns and you know, just the way it flows. And then again, today it's you see it everywhere. In Prague, it's a touristy thing, you know, so a cafe will have it in the cafe's name will be in the Mucha writing. It's almost like a default font. And you'll see his artwork everywhere.
So, yeah. You know, yeah. I think you would be, hard-pressed to find someone that wouldn't want to have a dedicated museum here to him in Prague, because Prague wants to say that he was one of theirs. However, when you talk about this going back and forth and not getting paid what he thought he was worth at the time, a lot of people feel that his hometown of Ivanchica, which is just very close to Brno in Moravia, would be the natural home for it. And so there's a legal battle still to this day back and forth about things. Yeah. So if you want to see the Slav epic, you may have to wait, or you may have to drive to Brno to go see it.
It's still not settled like that. So that also, there's fights that have been going on since his lifetime, basically, his son and his grandson. The Slav epic has sat in storage for 25 years. No one got to see them. And just like, what?
I mean, litigation at the worst.
And honestly, yeah, if you go to the Mucha Museum in Prague today, I got to say the space, the Mucha Museum itself, does not do it justice. I mean, they have it's a fantastic collection. Like, the collection is better than the museum is what I'm saying. It's not properly funded. It's underappreciated. It's you know, so go there and give them a large tip in their donation jar. So they can, you know, fight for these things and for them to be preserved. And it's a fantastic collection. You'll see some sketches. You really see, first of all, how his art form evolved from a painting. They have some of the original from Paris, some of the screen, the printings for the theater plays, and then some of his later works. And then, of course, they actually have some of the Pan-Slavic, those huge paintings. At least they did temporarily when I was there. I don't remember.
Now, are you talking about the Prague Modern Museum where they held the Slavic?
No, it's the Alfons Mucha Museum or something like
okay,
that.
Okay, so different one. Okay.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's more than one. But that's what I'm saying. Right. Like, for the collection they have, if you go there, you will to that one place I'm talking about. You'll first of all see the whole evolution from Pan-Slavism to his first sketches, to pictures of a studio and all that stuff, and of his life. To you'll also see the range of his workflow, his first sketches to the tracing to the now the in pen to the printing to the final product, and you really get a glimpse of how it all worked and how he put it all together and how he worked as an artist on his daily day job kind of thing, and it's just a great museum and underfunded and smaller than it should be kind of.
I'd hope people don't hate me by saying this, but I think that there's a Norman Rockwell quality, American quality that you can see that probably Norman Rockwell got from Mucha, and I think that's the first thing when I went in to see some of Mucha's work here in Prague. I went, "Wow, that is he's captured some a human being so exactly, almost like a photograph, that you would see." And I think that both of them have this in common. At one point in their careers, they commercialized their artwork so that they made the standard for what that was, be it the Saturday Evening Post by Norman Rockwell or by, being a poster for theater by Mucha. I don't think it detracts who they are because you have to feed yourself, man. I mean, sometimes you got to be commissioned and do something so you can get by.
Yeah, if anything, the negativity comes from that he is so popular that if you go to a tourist shop in Prague, you're just saturated with
aprons, coins,
10 little marijuana boxes with
that's right, Art Nouveau.
And he was like, "Oh, really?" Calendars, pencils, earrings, refrigerator magnets, and it's just kind of like, okay, I get it. It's been done. But if you go and see some of the originals and look at, the scale, how big they are, and even the theater posters, the original prints are big. And, he did sets of four, like the Four Seasons, he did many sets of four, and they're just amazing to see. And, but of course it's just like, it's so cliche almost. Like, you go to a cafe, of course it's going to be, Art Nouveau trimmings and Art Nouveau, fonts and menus and maybe even a Mucha hanging up, and so it's just like, okay, next, please. I want to see something else. But it's popular because it's beautiful. It's popular because there is something to it. Absolutely.
And I think also as we end the show tonight, I think he is popular because he's in the hearts of his countrymen in the sense that during the time of the early 20th century, when nationalism and a cultural identity was just coming out for the Czechs to hold on to, they had somebody that was a rock star status to say, "Hey, he's one of us. He's a Czech. He's Slavic. And look what we can do." And I think that that's something that is still respected by people here in the Czech Republic because of his international standing of being an artist that really set the tone for his style of art. Well, before we leave you tonight, we want to make sure that you get a chance to take a look at some of the other things that we're doing and take a listen to as well. You can go to our Bohemican YouTube channel to see some of our stories that we can give you a visual representation upon, or go to podcastnik.com to see all our projects we're working on, from the Bohemican podcast to the history of Germany to the secret cabinet that Travis works on and translates. You'll get to see some of the history of alchemy, our sister podcast we have for that show. You'll get to be get to more information about what we do for that, as well as some of the other side projects we do. We're running books. We're trying to do some other endeavors out there to kind of get our interests out to you, our listeners and our viewers. And we think that hopefully 2016 will be an amazing year for us to kind of really break open that door on all these different types of media that we're trying to do right now.
Speaking of, the latest YouTube video is in fact the 70th. Pete and I headed over to Pilsen for the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Pilsen by Allied U.S. troops, in fact, at the end of World War II. And it's the one and only time I took my grandfather's army uniform out of my closet and put it on and, you know, headed out to town. And you know, so it's just incredibly put together. It's about 11-minute video and just really well done. I would say like documentary quality production on Pete's behalf here. Really great YouTube video. So just go to YouTube and look for the Bohemican YouTube channel, or even type in, you know, 70th anniversary Pilsen liberation, that kind of thing. You'll find it. Or just go to bohemican.com. There's a link to the YouTube channel there.
We wanted to make it more like a time machine, so you get a chance to see what 1945 was like on May 8th,
cool. It's well done. Yeah.
When the Americans rolled into Pilsen to liberate the town.
I almost forgot. We interviewed Helen Patton, like General Patton's granddaughter. We just had a great time. We went there for more than one day, so we went back and got more shots the second day. So yeah, it was great.
All right. Well, for Travis Dow, I'm Pete Coleman. I want to say goodnight from Prague.
You have been listening to the Bohemican Podcast with Pete Coleman and Travis Dow. Visit bohemican.com for more information on this episode, other episodes, and much more information about history, traditions, and culture in the Czech Republic. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, and review, and don't forget to rate us. We would love to hear from you. Send comments, ideas, and corrections on our comments page on bohemican.com, or get in touch via Facebook or Twitter. Tune in to our sister podcast, History of Alchemy, which is also on iTunes or on historyofalchemy.com. Until next time on the Bohemican Podcast, thank you for listening.